Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan. Really appreciate you being here. Today on the podcast, we have Q&A, head of customer experience at Foundation. Foundation makes the very popular Passport hardware wallet, as well as a software wallet, Envoy. And in this discussion, Q&A and I get into a lot of things. We talk a lot about their hardware wallet, the design that goes into it, what its intentions are, as well as software wallets and where we see the industry going. And at the very end, Q&A shares a very interesting and spicy, unpopular opinion that you don't want to miss. So make sure you listen all the way through. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Q&A here. Thank you so much for taking time. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how's it going?
Going great. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I think you're actually the first person from a hardware wallet manufacturer that we've had on, and love your product. I actually was just every month I'm testing, signing new transactions, just making sure everything's working smoothly and the engine is well lubricated. So I was using your device just the other day. Wanted to start with your background. So you work for Foundation now, maker of the popular Foundation Passport hardware device. What were you doing before Foundation, and what led you to working with this company?
Yeah, so I always start my kind of backstory by saying that I wasn't doing anything Bitcoin related before I joined Foundation. I wasn't doing anything remotely related to my current job role right now. I worked in a kind of faceless, massive company based in the UK where I was one employee out of about 120,000. Wasn't very cared about. It was very much just a number somewhere in the middle of the great engine that made that company work. I won't share the details for personal reasons, but it was just kind of a generic middle management job looking after a small team of people with, plenty of people above me to kind of dictate all of the bureaucracy and the red tape. And that was the kind of impetus for me to want to jump ship from, I guess, what most of us Bitcoiners would call fiat land. I was kind of disenfranchised around the COVID time with the way that the company was going and the policies that I was having to uphold whilst not believing in them at all, should I say. So I found that quite frustrating to be having to kind of toe the party line, so to speak, and to do that day in, day out when I didn't believe in any of it was slowly driving me into the depths of hell. Obviously, in my spare time, I was very much falling head over heels for the concept of Bitcoin and what Bitcoin can do for us as a humanity. So it was a perfect storm, I guess, of me slowly, the slow growing hate for my fiat job, and also wanting to spend more and more time learning about this Bitcoin thing and more specifically how Bitcoin worked. Obviously, Bitcoin can draw people in via many, many, many different ways. And, the kind of trough or the amount of different ways that can draw people in grows every single day. For me, it was more of the technical aspect, which is kind of funny because I'm by no means a developer. I can just about sort of poke my way around the command line in a very, very basic fashion. Don't have a background based in IT or anything of the sorts, but I just find a real hunger for wanting to understand how Bitcoin worked and the more technicalities of it, of how to put that into practice in terms of like, okay, I understand that we need wallets and we've got private keys and all this different jargon, but I wanted to understand why we needed these things, how to secure them properly, and how to take that into my own hands and do it myself. I guess I delved into the community side of Bitcoin really heavily, more specifically within Telegram, where I found a number of different communities that were centered around the different pieces of wallet software, some of which are still going, some of which are sadly not here anymore, and found some really awesome connections there with people who had been in the space for much longer than myself, and were very generous with their time, and helped me learn along the way and feed that kind of incessant need that I had to understand the nuts and bolts of how and why these wallets were constructed in the way they were and how that interlinked with the wider ecosystem. And that expanded to things like nodes and multisig and all that sort of more technical side of Bitcoin as well. And as I started to learn more and more and get more and more entrenched into the communities that these wallets had around them, I slowly, over the course of like 12 to 18 months, went from the guy asking the questions to the guy answering the questions. And that became a bit of a love affair of mine and a bit of a passion of mine whilst I was still in my fiat job of spending way too much time in Telegram chats trying to help people walk the same journey as I had done over the past, the preceding 12 to 18 months. And eventually my spare time quickly ran out because, you know, the more and more people were learning about Bitcoin, and I was just one person of a handful that was, you know, willing to spend their time in these Telegram communities to try and help people, which is understandable. People have busy lives. And this was before I had kids and worked at a Bitcoin startup. So I had a lot more free time than I do today. I quickly ran out of time to be able to help as many people as I wanted to. So I took a step back and thought, how can I achieve this? How can I scale this? So I decided to try and build a website, which at the time was called BitcoinQ&A.com, hence the pseudonym. That's where that came from. And it was designed to be a simple Bitcoin questions and answers website. So if you wanted to learn the basics and you, like me, didn't want to read a 40-minute essay on why Bitcoin is great from a financial perspective or something like that, you could come to my website and just find the basics in short form, spend 10 minutes there, and then go off and enjoy the rest of your day. And I guess the rest, as they say, is history. That website has slowly evolved, and I've added to it over the course of, well, up until today, really. And it's grown until it's basically a bit of a treasure trove of all things kind of Bitcoin technical, so that you can learn, start from the basics and then go right up to, you know, demonstrations of how you can set up a 2 or 3 multisig in Sparrow using 3 different hardware wallets. You can kind of choose your own journey and really sort of get under the hood of why or how to use the tools correctly. The observant amongst the listeners, I guess, will know by now that the website is no longer called BitcoinQ&A.com. It morphed into Bitcoiner.guide, which came from another kind of love affair of mine of purchasing domains, way too many domains than I had uses for. Bitcoiner.guide quickly became my favorite. So I thought, well, I may as well make that my main handle for where I can direct people to my content and let them go and read all my stuff. And it's just a nice, easy URL that kind of rolls off the tongue quite nicely and is a little bit of a flex at the same time, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It is a fantastic website. I was reading through it just in the last couple of days, and a lot of good content. So Bitcoin.guide, check it out. How did you find Foundation, or how did they find you? And then maybe could you talk a little bit about your role as head of customer experience?
Yeah, so as the website that I've just mentioned, Bitcoiner.guide, grew in popularity, and I started to build up, I guess, a little bit of a modest following on Bitcoin Twitter and in these Telegram communities. One of the communities that I was in was the Foundation Devices community, which was run at the time by Zach, my boss and the CEO of our company. And obviously he had heard of the website and saw that I'd been doing various different guides on how to use hardware wallets and multisig wallets, etc., and just reached out. This was early days in the company in late 2020, when they had just launched their Founders Edition, the Generation 1 Passport hardware wallet. And he offered to send me one so that I could give some feedback and to do a guide onto my website so that people could learn about the device and see how to set it up and see that it was, you know, quite a different device compared to what was on the market at the time. So I did so, and Zach was really impressed and was thankful that I did the guide. And from there, we just carried on chatting. And I just out of the blue just said to him, look, I know you guys aren't actively recruiting. You're kind of still very much in startup phase, but if and when you ever grow enough to get to the size where you need a dedicated support person, give me a shot at an interview. I'd love to, you know, transition into the Bitcoin sphere and make that my, you know, turn my passion into my job. And luckily the kind of, I guess, being a little bit cheeky paid off, because the company did continue to grow and it did need to bring somebody on. Zach gave me a shot at an interview, and, you know, I was a successful candidate, and I'm still here almost 4 years on now. Time's flying.
That's so fun. Yeah, I can relate. Moving from the fiat mines into a full-time Bitcoin gig is about as good as it gets. It's like the weight of fiat is lifted off your shoulders. So as head of customer experience, are you Are you like overseeing a support team, or are you working on product development, ensuring that like the customer experience, the UI, the UX is all what you want it to be? Or where do your responsibilities begin and end?
Good question. In short, all of the above. The employment criteria at Foundation is that I think Zach calls it that we employ T-shaped people, which means that, yeah, you might be brought on for a kind of specific niche. It might be design, it might be support, but he or the team now actively looks for people that are able to spread their wings and take on responsibility that might not be considered as part of their normal remit. So yeah, when I first started off, it was purely just writing documentation, doing tutorial videos, and obviously being the face of the company when people come to us for support. That's since grown over the past 3 to 4 years into me managing a small team of people doing the same, answering support queries, managing the Telegram community. But then one of the more fun sides of it is, as you suggested there, was helping shape the product development process with a lens. You know, I try to be the lens of how our customers see any of the decisions that we make, be that from a hardware perspective or from a software perspective. And as you can appreciate, you know, we have both hardware and software products on the market now. We're constantly making updates and improvements to those. So that's a continual process that never ends, essentially. So any changes that are made to the hardware or the software, I'm obviously one small part of making, you know, sure we make the right decisions to make sure that those changes fit with our brand language, our ethos, and what we're trying to achieve in the niche that we're trying to carve out into the market.
Yeah, I think that's a good transition into the Foundation Passport. So could you talk a bit about what makes the device unique? How would you describe, to your point there, you know, it's becoming a more and more competitive, you know, growing market around hardware devices specifically. We'll get to Envoy, but what is it that gives the Passport its unique value proposition in your eyes?
Yeah, there's many things, but I'll start with the basics for those that have listeners that haven't actually heard what Passport is and how it works, etc. So Passport is our air-gapped hardware wallet. So by air-gapped, we mean that it is able to be connected in terms of its normal operation. You don't need to connect it to a computer like some of the other hardware wallets for it to kind of sign transactions and things like that. So there's no Wi-Fi, there's no USB connectivity, no Bluetooth, no wireless communications of any sort. All of this is completely intentional to bolster up, or I guess on the flip side to that, minimize the attack surface of the device. Because this device has two main purposes. It generates your seed words or your private keys, and then it keeps them safe and in an offline environment. The more and more that we can reduce the ways in which it's theoretically possible to attack that device, the more secure it is and the safer your Bitcoin is, essentially. So that's why we took the architectural decision of making sure that this device is air-gapped. Now, that does present some user experience hurdles. Namely, most people expect to just plug things in and for them to work, or if it's to be working over Bluetooth or NFC or something like that. Obviously, in an air-gapped environment, the two main ways that Passport is able to communicate with other pieces of software, be they on your phone or on your computer, is via either a micro SD card, where you kind of save some information to the SD card and then pass it back and forth, which in my opinion is not quite as elegant as our preferred method, which is via QR codes. So the way in which that works is when you want to kind of sign a transaction or communicate with, let's say, the Envoy application on our phone, the information is just encoded into some QR codes that are animated. And what I mean by that is that they just kind of quickly change from one to the next. And then you use the camera on device to scan that information to pass it back and forth. Sounds like it could be quite convoluted, but in reality, what it means is that you can authorize transactions in this air-gapped fashion, maintaining the highest possible security in like 10 to 15 seconds. So it's quite a slick setup process, and that's how we kind of maintain the most important part of a hardware wallet, which is, of course, its security and keeping your keys safe and secure. In terms of the differentiators, I guess, compared to the rest of the Bitcoin hardware wallet scene, most of the devices that you'll see are kind of take the form of like a USB stick, where they'll either, number one, need to be plugged into your computer to operate. They'll also probably have quite a small screen and maybe one or two buttons. which again, I'm not trying to throw shade on our competitors. Some of them do some awesome work. But in my opinion, it can make interacting with these devices less than optimal is the polite way I'll probably put it. Over on Passport, we've got a much larger bright colored display and a full T9 style keyboard, which for anybody over the age of 30, I'm sure they know exactly what I mean. But for anyone under the age of 30, T9 keyboard is kind of the older style keyboard that you see on the oblong kind of rectangular shaped Nokia phones. The reason I use the Nokia reference is that that's the first thing that most people say when they pick up the device is, oh, it looks like an old Nokia, which is kind of partially intentional on the design part because it looks and feels familiar in the hand, again, to people over a certain age, I guess. But it's all part of this holistic approach that we take to make sure that this device, of course, is secure. That's why I mentioned that first, but also that it's not intimidating to use. You don't need to kind of squint over a tiny screen. You don't need to figure out which button does what because it's just a stereotypical keyboard. The menu system is nice and easy to navigate. And we just want to make self-custody, or more specifically cold storage self-custody, as approachable and as achievable for as many people as possible.
You guys have done an excellent job of that. I think that's the noticeable thing for me versus other hardware wallets I've used is the intuitive interface. And probably someone over 30, it is familiar. Like it really feels a lot like my first cell phone back when I was in middle school or something. Very straightforward. But then how do you think about like moving forward? Is your thought that over time you just continue to perfect the Passport, or do you have like on your roadmap additional devices with maybe, you know, more or less features at different price points, or what do you have like a sense as to like where this goes a year from now, a couple of years from now, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to be careful with obviously how much I share publicly of our roadmap. So I'll be kind of general in my summarization, but whilst we believe that we do the best job of making air gap security as easy and approachable as possible, that only gets you so far up the ladder in terms of how many people are willing to kind of get to the bottom of or understand how to use this type of device. So we would see us moving into a world where we have more than one device. Passport will remain as the kind of, you know, the flagship, the ultimate in terms of air gap security. But for those that are comfortable with different trade-offs of different, you know, form factors or different connectivity types that open up the doors to make UX even easier, whilst of course having those trade-offs, we definitely see that there's a market for that. And you can see that if you look at elsewhere within the hardware wallet market, that people are now incorporating things like NFC or Bluetooth, and you know, those devices, they're selling significant amounts of those devices, which is a clear signal to the market that there is a certain percent of the population that want a hardware wallet that are comfortable with those trade-offs because they value the ease of use more than the additional theoretical protection that an air gap would give them versus, you know, whatever feature it is that you want to reference that one has versus the other. So yeah, we would love to move into that sort of space and produce a device that is in a different form factor with different trade-offs. Absolutely. And of course, we're a hardware wallet a hardware company first and foremost. So these types of devices take, you know, sometimes years to bring to market. So we're always working on the next thing, and we've got lots of irons in the fire, should I say.
Yeah, I believe it. And that's an interesting point. It's something we take for granted because one of our requirements for the devices that we support at the Bitcoin Way is that they're air-gapped, Bitcoin only, open source. And so you guys check the boxes. But I think, you know, you hit on something that is just probably an unfortunate truth, is that over time, as new entrants come into the space, new individuals, businesses onboard, you know, Bitcoin is like a form of savings. The reality is they're probably going to be custodying less Bitcoin than some of the early adopters. And so for them to have like that clean, easy interface, just like the simplest way possible, people probably are going to compromise a bit on, you know, what features they're comfortable with. And, you know, you're going to be selling to just like a new audience, right? Like right now you've got cypherpunks and kind of, you know, what I think of as like disagreeable early adopters. So I imagine it's this constant, you know, balancing act that you probably have, you know, like security and convenience, because you can't have it all. Is that just like a constant point of conversation as you guys are building out features and products?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you should mention that, really, because the other parts of my job that I failed to mention when I gave a quick rundown of that is we offer a concierge product service where when you purchase a passport, you can also opt to have me hop on a call or one of my colleagues to help you set the device up. When I first started running those calls, obviously at that point, I'd been entrenched into the kind of Bitcoin ecosystem for at least kind of 4 years at that point. And I had this preconceived notion, because I understood things, that, oh, you know, I find this easy, so everybody else is going to find this easy. And I quickly had quite a big slap in the face when I started hopping on calls with our customers and trying to explain what I thought were really basic topics, or basic concepts of how to use a certain device in a certain way. And you could see the look on these people's faces that, you know, as if I was talking in a different language to them. And that's a kind of reality check that I try to give myself as often as possible, is that you forget how much you know sometimes and how much you just pick up via osmosis of, you know, listening to podcasts every single day, that most of the Bitcoin population aren't even aware of, let alone fully understand. So it's very useful for me to continually be able to speak to our customers on a one-to-one basis to understand the questions that they are coming up against, or the sticking points in, let's say, a certain part of our menu system. If I can see multiple people getting stuck over a certain thing, that can then feed the feedback loop, I suppose, that when I go back to the team and we're making design decisions on a certain menu system, I can be like, oh, actually, I've spoken to multiple customers that have got stuck with this. Maybe we need to tweak this imagery. Maybe we need to change the way we communicate this little concept, that type of thing. So yeah, it's very interesting and a useful part of my job to be able to do that. Another kind of great feedback loop is, or I guess I would call it somewhat of a dichotomy, where I am much like yourself, I'm sure, are on Bitcoin Twitter and Bitcoin Nostr every single day. And we have the vocal early adopters, of which, you know, we have many at Foundation, and we're very thankful for their early support and their invaluable feedback. Lots of those type of customers they're very much in the minority in terms of our overall sales volume, but they are absolutely in the majority in terms of the feedback that we get. And it's a very tricky line for us to walk between adding in those features that actually get requested versus how many of those features, or the impact that implementing those features would have on what is most of our customer base, which are just, you know, your average mom and pop that just want to secure some Bitcoin. They're not even on Bitcoin Twitter. They might have found us at a conference, or they might have stumbled across us via a single YouTube video, and they have no concept of everything that we're talking about on Bitcoin Twitter every day. And so we're constantly fighting an internal battle of course, we want to add all these power user features, but we don't want to do that in such a way that's going to confuse most of our customer population, because that's not a good business decision. So it's a fine line to walk, and one that we go back and forth on every single day. And especially for myself, as I guess one of the faces of the company, is a difficult hurdle for me to get over, to be able to communicate that sometimes we have to just say no to a certain feature, and being able to communicate that in such a way that we're not just like, no, do you know what? We don't think it's right fit for us. Trying to get that across in such a way that is constructive, I would say.
Yeah. So do you, like today then, is there a particular segment of Bitcoiners that you view as your primary target market? Like, have you been able to distill, you know, kind of, you made that distinction of like the people who are loudest in terms of voicing opinions and giving you feedback. Who in your mind is buying Passport today versus, you know, one of the other hardware wallets?
I would use the concierge calls that I referenced earlier as my kind of gauge. Obviously, I see these customers and I talk to those customers day in, day out, and most of them are kind of, I guess, upwards of 30. and just wanting to secure some Bitcoin. And I can tell immediately by the way, the types of questions that they're asking and what they want to achieve with the device, it's the absolute bare minimum of, you know, I understand that I need to self-custody. I might be a little bit intimidated by the rest of the offerings in the market. And I'm appreciative that you guys have offered to help my, you know, hold my hand as part of this setup process. But generally speaking, it's people that want to just get over that bar of self-custody. And they want to do that in the easiest way possible with the best UX. And clearly, you know, obviously we're thankful that they've gravitated to, you know, this device to be able to take those steps, because and that's, I guess, is great feedback for us, because it means that we're targeting ourselves at the right types of people. Because yeah. Don't get me wrong, there's, again, I don't ever try to trash our fellow hardware wallet manufacturers, but some of them are much more easy to use. Some of them are much more harder to use. And I've had countless times where I've hopped on these calls and they said, oh yeah, I've got hardware wallet X. And do you know what? It's been sat in my drawer for 2 years because the look of it just intimidates me. That happens way more than you would think, actually. So yeah, generally speaking, just to round it off, is people that just need to self-custody and want the easiest possible solution. I'll tell you another kind of anecdote. A lot of people have migrated to us after recent kind of, how shall I call them, business decisions that have been taken by Ledger. A lot of people have woken up to, you know, the multiple, I guess, foot guns that they've done over things like Ledger Recover, where they quite literally kind of backdoor your device and make you pay for it. So we're, again, kind of tongue in cheek a little bit, thankful for some free marketing from competitors making some silly decisions.
Yeah. I'm hopeful that, you know, like it's sort of the analogy I'd use is like every cycle we see people get rugged on exchanges and we see all of this. And I'm hopeful that some of those very poor decisions from certain wallet manufacturers that we would never recommend or support, that learning curve is shortened for new people. Because as we go from like early adopters into a more mainstream adoption, which I anticipate happening here, you know, soon in the next couple of years, at least, it's going to be so useful to have something sufficiently intuitive that isn't going to rug you, that can't rug you. There's no option for that because there's no back door. It's all open source. And I think some of these additional features that you're talking about, I think are only going to position you better for that time. Like right now, my sense is that the sort of people in Bitcoin, like the average Bitcoiner, is probably more likely to spend a bit more time trying to figure it out, tinkering, you know, piecing their self-custody setup together. It sounds to me like you're already receiving a lot of the people who are less inclined to that because it is such an intuitive interface. But I can just only imagine, you know, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, how much more important that interface, the user interface, becomes, because it's going to be people like, you know, my family members who are, you know, less excited about Bitcoin than I am and are never going to spend the time to learn how to set up a wallet that is, you know, at best a bit frustrating to sort of walk through. So kudos to you for what you guys are doing. And I think the vision is a good one. Could you talk a little bit about Envoy? Talk about your software wallet, how it ties in with your hardware business or not, places where you could use it independently, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. Envoy started out life, which, to be clear, is a mobile application, cross-platform, available on Android and iOS. You can also download it directly from our GitHub if you don't like to use the app stores. It's an open source mobile wallet that actually started life that without the kind of traditional mobile wallet feature that most people come to kind of know and understand. It started life as just a companion application for Passport, so that you can kind of use it in, I guess, what we would colloquially term the watch-only function, where you would pair Passport via QR codes with the Envoy app on your phone, such that the app was able to show you your transactions and be able to construct spend transactions for you, so that obviously you're unable to do that on Passport because it's completely air gap, like I mentioned earlier. Envoy was kind of the transaction coordinator, obviously built by us to be, from the ground up, the best companion possible for Passport. So that's how it started out its life. And that came from a place of us thinking that there weren't that many great mobile-based alternatives at the time. We had Blue Wallet. We had, I don't even think Nunchuk existed. But obviously, we wanted to put our own kind of stamp on it, our own design language, and make it, again, like I said, custom-built for Passport so that it was the user experience to help you get from setting the device up to then managing your transactions was unparalleled, specifically for Passport. Okay. After that, the next natural progression was, of course, to add a mobile wallet feature as well so that you can have the best of both worlds and you can manage both of those accounts within a single application so that you don't, if you don't want to, need to look elsewhere and have to deal with third-party pieces of wallet software, which were compatible with all of the good ones, by the way. Want to stress that Envoy is completely optional. If you don't like it, you never have to use it. It's not a prerequisite for Passport. But yeah, to go back to the story, yeah, we then added mobile wallet functionality. And again, we wanted to put our own stamp on it because we saw the shortcomings that other, or not shortcomings, trade-offs that other wallets made in terms of user experience and the types of backups that they used to make people, or still do, make people kind of go through. So we took the, I guess some deem it somewhat controversial opinion or outlook, creating what we call magic backups, which I don't think it's been done anywhere else. So the way it works is that you can set up a mobile wallet within Envoy, where the private keys live solely on your phone. So this is, a hot wallet designed for smaller amounts of Bitcoin. It's absolutely not for your life savings. You can set one of those up in two taps, literally two taps. And what you get with those two taps is a mobile wallet where the keys are stored in the secure enclave of your mobile phone. But they'll also be automatically stored in an encrypted form in your chosen cloud provider. So if you're an Apple user, that will be sent straight to your iCloud. And if you're a Google user, it will be sent to what's called your Android Auto Backup. Now, again, we did that because we are geared towards making things as simple as possible for people, and knowing full well that people aren't going to jump into straight away writing down 12 words and understanding the importance of that. With our magic backups, because it's all automatic and it goes encrypted up to your cloud, if you start to use this mobile wallet and then you do the normie thing where you don't write down your seed words and then your phone breaks or it gets stolen or any of the above, all you need to do to restore access to those funds is grab a new phone, sign into your iCloud account or your Google account, and then download Envoy, and it will just magically pull down your seed word from your personal cloud, and all of your funds are restored. Now, we understand that that's a trade-off that not everybody's willing to make, even if it is just a hot wallet for smaller amounts. And of course, in the as with everything that we build at Foundation, we give you choice. If you don't want to use those magic backups, you can just use Envoy in what we call kind of, I guess, the standard backup method, where you don't use any cloud services. You can just generate 12 words on device, write them down on a piece of paper or stamp them into steel, and then go and be on your merry way and just not use any cloud backups at all. You've always got that choice. Once again, it's never, ever mandatory. The cool thing about these magic backups, though, just to go back to kind of the easy mode, as I like to call it internally, is that we also store in an encrypted form, once again, all of the metadata from your wallet as well. So let's say you've added multiple Passport accounts and you've connected those and you manage those within Envoy. You've got loads of different transactions and you've been really robust with kind of using our tags feature or adding transaction notes. You've given all of these accounts different names, all of that sort of kind of nice to have metadata that's, again, nice to have, but non-essential in terms of a recovery process. All of that is also saved within your magic backup if you use the wallet on easy mode. So once again, what that looks like in a recovery scenario is that you sign into your iCloud, you download Envoy, and not only do you restore access to your funds, but you get all of that metadata back as well. So account names, tags, notes, and basically the wallet looks exactly as it did before you lost your phone or you dropped it down the toilet or anything like that. So that's, again, one of my favorite features because we called it magic backups for a reason. It is just magic and it just works, especially when it comes to recovery time. If you need to, you know, you ever find yourself in that sort of predicament where you unfortunately do lose your phone.
That's very cool. Like I understand that what you're doing is, as a user, is you're compromising on security for the sake of convenience. But I think to the point you made, this is an important one. we're very, very, very principled at the Bitcoin Way about how you do self-custody, cold storage, and like that's your savings. That's the generational wealth that you're building. But when it comes to just, you know, daily transactions, like the ability to leverage your Bitcoin, obviously signing every transaction with your hardware wallet and, you know, having it in air gap mode, and maybe you need to be at, you know, your home computer where you've got your software wallet downloaded, it's going to prolong our ability to move to like a medium exchange use case. And so having that sort of functionality, I think, for just to your point again, a bit of Bitcoin for daily funds spending, mm-hmm. you know, sending and receiving, I think is very important. And the easier you can make it, the better. And I think especially as we, again, reach this more mainstream adoptive phase, those sorts of tools become more and more important. I'm curious, you have something you wanted to say on that?
No, I was just going to say some of the key features that I forgot to mention about Envoy, which are going to be important to most people that listen to this, is that it has built-in Tor connectivity to protect your network level privacy. You can connect it to your own Bitcoin node if you run one as well. And we do have quite a big roadmap planned for Envoy, and it's going to become a much bigger player within the Foundation ecosystem over the course of the next 12 months. And it's probably the product that I'm most excited about. Guess I can drop a very obvious hint, but Lightning is on its way, and I'm very excited about it.
Okay. Yeah, you answered my next question. I was wondering if we were talking Lightning, on-chain, or both. I think that's going to be, I mean, you know, you hear about people talking in the coming years, fewer and fewer people will own UTXOs and will have the ability to custody UTXOs. And so I think just the ability to have something like a software wallet with Lightning integration is going to be more and more common. Whether it's optimal or not is almost unimportant, because it's just going to be the option available to many people. So with all of this, I mean, you're effectively a manufacturer and you've got a software development, you know, division, so to speak. Are there any like regulatory considerations that you have to deal with when it comes to this? I mean, I guess particularly I'm curious with like the mobile wallet. I know nothing about regulatory considerations for like a software company doing this sort of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I know our kind of founders are constantly looking at, especially with some of the different cases that are going on within the US with things like Tornado Cash and Samurai Wallet, which, you know, are obviously horrible situations, and something that I watch closely as a privacy advocate, and I know our C-suite does as well. All you can do, I guess, is operate within what you think or what you understand to be the existing framework. We have changed course a few times based on what's going on. We did have a CoinJoin implementation planned. We were going to implement the Whirlpool CoinJoin, and we could see the regulatory environment heating up. This was before the Samurai case happened, by the way. I guess it was some good foresight by you know, our founders. But yeah, I guess it's just one of those things that you've got to kind of monitor on, because we're in a new industry, although it, you know, sometimes it feels like I've been here for decades, which means that the regulatory landscape is constantly shifting. So something that we keep an eye on constantly. But I guess in terms of like the core principles, we will never ever build something that custodies user funds. And that's kind of like the core pillar of what's going to put you in the crosshairs of the regulators, is are you taking custody of funds? We're never going to build something like that, because it's just, in my opinion, is not worth the hassle to be able to, you know, move into that sort of market. So that would be the main one that we kind of, I know that we stray away from. There might be others that our founders are kind of cognizant of that maybe they're not communicating, but that would be the key pillar that I know that we're absolutely just not interested in.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I don't blame you. It sounds like a nightmare. So I mentioned a minute ago, you know, a day when UTXO ownership becomes more rare, people are probably going to be onboarded into Bitcoin on a second or even third layer. First of all, do you believe that to be true over some time horizon? And if so, how do you think about the impact to your business, particularly your hardware business and the business model around that moving forward? Is, you know, do you anticipate like it Foundation becomes more effectively a software company, or do you think we have a long runway where hardware devices are going to be completely essential?
Yeah, so I absolutely share the assumption or the thought process that UTXOs are going to become more and more prohibitively expensive. the bit where I kind of veer off from the, I guess, the common thought process is that I think our runway is much longer than most people might have you believe. Prime example of that, and it just, and I appreciate that this is a very quick snapshot, but as we record now, I'm looking over your shoulder, Bitcoin's at like 60-something thousand dollars. You go into mempool.space and you can get into the next block at 2 sats per byte. And I think that it's going to take a lot of sustained pressure for us to have kind of, or to make UTXOs prohibitively expensive in the short term. And I just don't see it happening for over the longer period is what I mean by that. Of course, we might have similar ordinal situations, which, you know, obviously pumped the fee market up to exorbitant levels temporarily, but we're quickly back down to almost 1 sat per byte to get back into the next block. And I see that continuing for at least like the next 10 years or so, in my opinion. Again, I'm just putting my finger in the air here. I don't have a crystal ball, but I just don't see there being such an immediate demand for self-custody over the next 12 years, such that, you know, UTXOs are so expensive that people are like, do you know what? I'm just not going to buy a hardware wallet. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably a fair position. And you've got 2 points there. Is one of them, I think there's a level of tech that needs to be built out in order to onboard people. Like right now, and for a period of time, the option is going to just be buying Bitcoin, or if you're fortunate to work at a Bitcoin company, earning in Bitcoin. But the second thing is, I've seen the numbers. I can't remember what they are, but the number of people who own Bitcoin today who are in self-custody with a hardware wallet, it's pretty low. And so you've got a lot of people, I think, who are still, I mean, people who are still on exchanges, right? That either they didn't learn their lesson from FTX and some of the others, or they think Coinbase or whoever is immune to those sorts of problems. And unfortunately, I think they're wrong. But the good news for you is that is, you know, probably 90, what, I feel like it's been like said, 90% of the market still is not using a hardware wallet. Is that sort of the sense that you have as well?
Yeah, I would say it's the overwhelming majority of people that I like to classify them as people that interact with Bitcoin are doing so mainly through custodial solutions like, well, most of those are exchanges. And the next big wave of self-custody and the next big wave, I guess, of hardware wallet purchasing is going to be driven by something like Coinbase blowing up or one of the ETFs being found that they don't have what they're claiming to have, etc. I think it's going to take something like that before we see any sort of, you know, huge rush.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think you're right. I mean, it's just, again, it's like every cycle we see new people learning the same old lessons because they haven't been here. They heard about FTX in the news maybe, but it wasn't really on their radar. It was just some guy who, you know, defrauded customers. It was, as far as they're concerned, it was just another Bernie Madoff. It wasn't, they can't draw the association that it was really just a mistake that a lot of people were making trusting a custodian with their Bitcoin when they don't have to. I think that's what I got for you on the hardware. One thing I'm just curious about, I wanted to ask you because you're the first person who remains anonymous that I've had on the podcast. And so as someone who is private with their identity, are there certain more rigorous privacy security related protocols that you think about, you follow, that might be beneficial to people regardless of whether or not they choose to stay anonymous?
What do you mean in terms of like the tools that I use on a day-to-day basis? Or
yeah, tools you use or sort of precautions that you take. I'm curious because I think a lot of people just take a lack of privacy for granted and they just share everything with anyone and they sign off on the terms and conditions and, you know, all proprietary tools, whether it's in, you know, the Android or the Apple ecosystem. What sort of things do you do that are different?
Yeah, I see. There's quite a number of tools and lots of low hanging fruit that the average person that's kind of starting to become interested in privacy could start to leverage. The things that I use every day start with a Linux operating system. I don't like to use Windows because of all its bloatware and it's not open source. And I don't like to use Mac regularly for the same reason. I use a Linux operating system called Pop OS. which is a very polished version of Ubuntu that makes things very, very easy to use. And I use that on a laptop that's running open source firmware as well. Once again, just to be a little bit more confident in the stuff that I'm using day to day, like how we're talking, how I communicate with my work colleagues, things like that. I'm just, you know, it gives me more confidence to be able to do that on a system that's open, you know, where I'm not being built within the walled gardens of Google, Apple, and Microsoft. Another great example is I run a Google Pixel device. I know that sounds ironic after the thing, what I've just said, but I run a Google Pixel device that runs an open source operating system that's been hardened for security and privacy. And the name of that is Graphene OS. Mm-hmm. Again, sounds like it's a really complex and technical thing to do, but I assure you, you can install this onto your Google Pixel in 5 minutes, and it looks and feels identical to normal Android. It's just been hardened at the operating system level to basically strip out all of the Google spyware so that Google just doesn't get an insight into literally every single thing that you do on your phone, which, again, is important to me. Be some other good examples. Just generally, in terms of when I'm choosing software to install on my phone or onto my computer, whenever I do that, I always look to use open source solutions first. And again, I do that for the same reason that open source is important in the hardware wallet industry, is that whilst I, as a non or less technical individual that's absolutely not a developer, may not be able to go and vet the code of, let's look at my doc here. What have we got? Sparrow Wallet. So I use Sparrow Wallet on my desktop. I have no idea what code is in there to make that application run as beautifully as it does. It's one of my favorite pieces of software. But I know that because the app is published under an open source license, and every single line of code is public, that there are enough clever people out there that are able to scrutinize that code, that it only takes one of those people to find something malicious going on in that software, raising a red flag to, well, you know how information quickly spreads on the internet these days. It takes one person to do a public tweet, it will blow up and raise the red flag for everybody. Say, hey, this open source piece of software is not actually doing what you think it's doing. You should probably stop using it and maybe don't trust it with your private keys. That kind of thought process can be applied to any piece of software that's open source. Obviously, open source is not a panacea. Just because something is maintained publicly doesn't mean it's safe and secure, but it raises the bar and makes it significantly more difficult than just installing some proprietary application that you have zero control over, that's essentially running in a black box and you have no idea what's going on. Could be spying on you, could be logging your keystrokes. So yeah, open source, pinnacle for me in terms of making selections on the software that I would install on any of my devices. Doesn't matter if it's my tablet, my phone, or my computers as well. So yeah, I think that would be the three main things that I kind of look at.
Right. Yeah. I'm in the same boat as you. I consider myself semi-technical. Our team is very technical. I like the idea. I like to think of it as thousands of eyes, especially if you're picking, you know, a well-proven, a robust tool like Sparrow, for example. Probably mm-hmm. thousands of eyes of competent developers have been on that code. And for me, I'd rather trust thousands of people who I don't know, who are smart and thoughtful and know their discipline well, than to assume that a single proprietary app is, you know, acting in my best interest, I guess. I was going to ask you, you say it was called Pop OS, that's the Linux?
Pop OS, yeah. It's produced, I think, by a company called System76, who actually make hardware as well. They make desktop computers and laptops. Some very good hardware, actually. But yeah, they also produce an operating system that's built predominantly on top of Ubuntu, which is one of the commonly used Linux distributions. So it takes that and kind of puts a really nice wrapper around it, such that if anybody comes to me and says, look, okay, I've heeded your warnings and I want to get out of the Apple ecosystem, or I've decided that Windows bloatware is not for me, I want to take the plunge and go to Linux, Pop OS for me is my go-to recommendation for people starting out. And the reason I say that is generally speaking, it just works. So once you install this operating system, you're probably not going to need to worry about installing drivers for your printer or plugging in a microphone and it not working. All of the common hardware is just going to work. And obviously that makes the kind of transition period from going like something more commonly used like Mac over to Linux much more smooth, and you know, is going to make people stick around for the long term, hopefully.
Yeah. What would you compare the user experience to? Does it feel more like Mac or Windows or something? I understand it's intuitive, but does it feel like something different or maybe one more than the other?
Yeah, I guess, well, it has the sort of similar type dock style as a Mac would run. So I guess that's probably the main kind of comparison I could draw. But generally speaking, they kind of, Linux distributions, you know, as wide ranging and varying as they are, you could kind of choose your own journey. If you want a Windows looking one, you can pick one. If you want one that's more similar to Mac, then you can pick that. I'd say it'd probably be unfair to kind of compare Pop OS to either of those. It kind of stands on its own. Yeah, I guess the thing I want to drive home is it makes things just really simple, and it will, I promise you, feel familiar because you just have a simple dock. You can have multiple workspaces like you can on a Mac. You can do multitasking, etc. Anything that you can do in these more commonly used operating systems, you can absolutely do that within Pop OS or within a Linux distribution. Obviously, how you access those features is going to differ slightly, but you know, that goes without saying.
Yeah, and then on the privacy phone, I know Graphene OS to be a great one. So and for anyone listening, this is something the Bitcoin Way does. We actually help people set up privacy phones. And funny enough, it does sound ironic, but we most of our clients will use a Google Pixel because you can de-Google it, install something like Graphene OS, and you still have like that intuitive interface that you're used to if you've used Android. And you know, even if you've used Apple, it's still I think a pretty straightforward transition for someone to make. So it sounds ironic that you would use a Google phone as a privacy phone, but there are ways to do it. So Q&A, my last question for you. This is one I ask everyone at the end of the show. I'll give you a minute to think about it if you need to. But what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and bonus points if it's unpopular even amongst Bitcoiners?
That won't actually take me that long to think of. And it's definitely unpopular against most Bitcoiners. Well, I say most Bitcoiners. What I mean by that is most Bitcoiners on Bitcoin Twitter. And that is that I think today more than ever that if you want to achieve true privacy, when you have a need to transact on a day-to-day basis, Monero, shock, yes, I said it, is not the end of the world. Like, it's not going to turn your fingers green and make you vomit, much like Bitcoin Twitter would make you believe. It can actually be a useful tool. If you have a need to transact daily or regularly, and you don't want to jump through the hoops of trying to attain privacy on Bitcoin, I would say that that is a viable alternative or an addition to your toolkit as a Bitcoiner, if you kind of are happy to fail the purity tests on Twitter.
Fair enough. One question on that. One thing I've never really looked into it. I've heard that before in terms of some of the privacy built into the base layer of Monero. Is the network sufficiently large that it's secure? I don't hear enough about it because I am in the Bitcoin echo chamber. That's been my concern. As I understand it, at the protocol level, there's baked in privacy that you don't have on Bitcoin. I'm curious if like the network effect is sufficiently large so as to have a secure network to begin with.
Yeah, let me start out by saying I am by no means even remotely an expert. This is just something I've been exploring a little bit more recently. So my experience is very, very kind of minimal. From my understanding, they operate, so they don't have like a hashing algorithm that is similar to Bitcoin's. They operate on a different sort of system. I'm not even going to try and kind of communicate what that is because I don't fully understand it. But what I do know is that this algorithm that they use is what they dub ASIC resistant. And I think if I, again, basic understanding is that it changes frequently such that it's not viable for you to build dedicated hardware for this, so that you don't get the horrible mining centralization that we unfortunately see in Bitcoin today, which in my opinion is one of the biggest threats that we have right now. Again, not going to try and guess how that works, but I think that is one of the protections that they have in terms of making sure that the mining is sufficiently distributed. Now, you could argue that that is also a weakness, that if somebody does find a chink in that armor and is able to produce dedicated hardware that is resistant to the ASIC resistance, if you're following me, then that could be an easy thing to exploit. But again, I'm just talking in ifs and buts here, and very much from a position that I don't have a full understanding of it. But yeah, I think you could actually argue that. And I guess it comes down to how resistant the ASIC resistance really is.
Okay. So you've heard it here from Q&A by Monero. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Store your wealth in Bitcoin. It's the best. It's the daddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun, very interesting. Why don't you give a quick handoff where people can find you, your Bitcoiner resources, and then anything foundation related?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure. And once again, thanks for being flexible whilst I was on death's door last week. Yeah, if you want to see my resources, it's at bitcoiner.guide. You can find me on Twitter at BTCQ&A. I'm also on Nosta, which you'll find the links from my Twitter to get there as well. But I'm sure if you search for Q&A, I'll pop up. And yeah, follow us over on Foundation to see what I spend my days helping build. Head to foundation.xyz and you'll have a showcase of both of our products there.
Fantastic. And I'll just add to that, you have great resources that you've developed personally and love your products. So make sure anyone listening, you go check out Q&A, check out Foundation. You'll be glad you did. Q&A, thanks, man. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on. Been a real pleasure.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I know I sure did. Q&A is a very interesting guy. Love that he takes his privacy so seriously. He talks about a lot of topics at the end of the episode related to privacy, phones, working with open source tools, all things you should take to heart. Make sure you go follow him. He also mentioned after we got off the call, he'd forgot to drop his podcast in there, which is ungovernablemisfits.com. And you can go check that out. They are a great resource. Foundation is a fantastic company building some very exciting products and a very useful and user-friendly hardware wallet. So follow them. You can also follow The Bitcoin Way on X. We're at @TheBitcoinWay_. Go to our website, thebitcoinway.com, to schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team to talk about privacy phones, online security, proper self-custody with no compromises of your Bitcoin. And we'd love to talk with you soon. You can also follow me on X. I'm at @TheOtherMJordan. Always appreciate feedback, comments, suggestions for the show. And look forward to hearing from many of you all soon. Until next time, this is Michael signing off.